Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 2nd of December 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshank, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 57 in our series here where we look at white contributions to history and civilization, and we've been particularly looking at Britain for the last dozen or so episodes. We started with Princess Albion, we moved on to Brutus, the Trojan Prince and his dynasty, we looked through the Roman era, and now we're into the Saxon era and a particularly important part of it when Roman Christianity came to England, supposedly to convert the Saxons. And of course, with me today, I have my two co-hosts, Patriarch and Truthvids. Patriarch, how are you doing, sir? How is life treating you?
Yes, Sven, I'm very well, thanks. Everything's good, just into the weather, I guess.
Excellent. That's lovely to hear. Truthvids from truthvids.net. How are you doing, sir? How is life treating you?
All good, Sven. Great to be here again. Looking forward to this episode. Thanks.
Yeah, I really do enjoy looking at our history. Once you become a nationalist, it's like you suddenly become connected to all these things that you read about with our extended family, and you just want to learn more and more about what it means to be British in the first place, and also white as well, and European. So it's great that we're concentrating on British history in particular at the moment, which is our extended family's history, basically. Last week, we talked a little bit about Augustine, and we talked about the pagan beliefs, and we talked about the conference that Augustine had called in order to speak to the British Church, and we're going to begin with that this week with R.W. Morgan. He says, Augustine, on the breaking up of the conference, threatened the Cymry that as they would not accept peace from their brethren, they should have war from their enemies. If they would not preach life to the Saxons, they should receive death at their hands. The insolence of this menace of a friar from a petty mission with just one chapel among the barbarian pagans of Kent to a church counting in Britain and on the continent four archbishoprics and 30 bishops among its officers, and such universities as Bangor and Llanilltid amongst its establishments, is only equalled by the falsehoods implied in it, that the British Church had never preached the gospel to the pagan invaders. All Scotland, Ireland and North Britain had, on the contrary, either been or were then in the course of being evangelised by missionaries of the British Church, many of them men of high birth and attainments, Patrick, Ninian, Paulinus, Columba, Aidan, Kentigern and others. The Isle of Wight and other parts within easy access of the Canterbury mission were not, on the contrary, converted until 50 years after this conference. So the British Church was really rather important. I mean, we've already heard about how these missionaries were sent out onto Europe in the first century, the second century, getting all the way to Switzerland. And then you've got this emissary of the Roman Church that has arrived here in Britain, and he's pretty much demanding that that the Cymry and the British Church should be subservient to the Roman Church. And of course, Rome had always been seen as this usurper, this invader, and now you've got these other invaders, you've got the Saxons that are starting to work their way into the country, and it's effectively saying that the British Church should be subservient to these Saxons and their archbishop as well, because Augustine was made into a bishop, and they made Canterbury into the archbishopric. We already had an archbishopric, which was St. David's. And the Britons continued to honour St. David's as being the main archbishopric right up until, I think, about the 11th century. I was reading the other day in Wikipedia on the Celtic Christianity section, which is quite interesting. It has some bits that are truthful and some bits that aren't. Truthvids, any thoughts on what R.W. Morgan has to say here about Augustine?
Yeah, it seems to be kind of rewriting history that he's came to try and get them under the sway of the Catholic Church. They've rejected it. So then he's claimed that, his mission was to convert the Saxons, and that he's claiming that the British aren't doing it. So they're going to be wiped out. But what's really happening is he's upset that they won't bow down to Rome, right? And we know that Britain was actually Christian before the churches in Rome. So it's you know, a bit of a lie here, but okay, right?
Yeah, I mean, it tells you how many archbishoprics and how many bishops that we actually had in Britain. We already had 30 bishops. So what's this new guy doing coming along and saying that he has authority over all the others? Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was wondering why they were unwilling to preach life to the Saxons. I mean, is it because of the bad blood that's been built up between them over the centuries?
Well, they were seen as invaders, but what it was saying here is that they had preached to them and they had set a good example to them, and the Saxons just didn't want to follow it. The Saxons saw them as beneath them and wanted to fight against them. So the Britons were fighting back, basically. If we move back to Wikipedia, Augustine failed to extend his authority to the Christians in Wales and Dumnonia to the west, and that's the Britons. Gregory had decreed, that's Pope Gregory, that these Christians should submit to Augustine and that their bishops should obey him, apparently believing that more of the Roman governmental and ecclesiastical organisation survived in Britain than was actually the case. And of course, that's Wikipedia trying to pretend that Christianity originated with the Roman Catholics rather than originated with the British Church in Rome. According to the narrative of Bede, the Britons in these regions viewed Augustine with uncertainty, and their suspicion was compounded by a diplomatic misjudgment on Augustine's part. In 603 AD, Augustine and Ethelbert, and Ethelbert was the king of Kent that was hosting Augustine because he had a Christian wife, his queen was Christian. Augustine and Ethelbert summoned the British bishops to a meeting south of the Severn. These guests retired early to confer with their people, who, according to Bede, advised them to judge Augustine based on the respect he displayed at their next meeting. When Augustine failed to rise from his seat at the entrance of the British bishops, they refused to recognise him as their archbishop. There were, however, deep differences between Augustine and the British Church that perhaps played a more significant role in preventing an agreement. At issue were the tonsure, that's the haircut that the British Church had, the observance of Easter, that's the date of Easter, and practical and deep-rooted differences in approach to asceticism, missionary endeavours, and how the church itself was organised. So basically, it was petty things, really, it seems to me, just a haircut, certain dates. I believe they also, they weren't baptising either. The British Church weren't actually using the ritual of baptism. I think that was a part of this, as well. Truth Fids, any thought on these differences between the British Church and the Church of Rome?
Yes, I think that the organisation part was the Roman Catholic Church was more of a top-down, pyramid, as they say, where the Pope had absolute authority, whilst in England there seems to have been a few archbishops who probably had equal authority, and, you know, there wasn't so much of a tyrannical type style. It was more that they were happy as long as people just obeyed the Christian commandments, right? And I believe there was something about the whole marriage thing, that the originally pagan priests, they wouldn't get married because they would claim they're married to their God. And this was kind of the Roman Catholic style, right? Bishops, etc., wouldn't get married, whilst in Britain, you know, they had families, and it was even passed on, you know, father to son. You were expected to, take over the career or job of your father and become, you know, a Christian priest or bishop as well, right? I don't know about the haircuts. I imagine in Britain they didn't bother with, you know, all these weird haircuts like the monk style where you have a bald spot. That would probably be more in Europe. That's how I imagine, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking there as well. I mean, what you were saying there about the priests, and they were allowed to get married. I mean, that's what St. Paul says, is that priests should be married. You need to be the head of a family to understand these problems that that you know your parishioners might come to you with. And that was changed by the Roman Catholic Church. And I think the Orthodox priests today, they can still get married. And the bit there about how their descendants would become priests. I mean, that's exactly what we had with the Levites in the Old Testament and with the Druids. It was a hereditary title. In fact, you had to show that you came from a particular family going back 10 generations in order to be a Levitical priest. And it was the same with the Druids. You had to show that you'd been a free man going back 10 generations before you could be a Druid. And I think that shows that the British Church had a link to, well, obviously it had a link to Druidry, but also a link to the Hebrew Levitical priesthood, because it was so important to them that it was only members of that caste could actually become priests. And that remained the same in the British Church. So obviously, if that's the way that the British Church's priesthood is arranged, then obviously you had to be married to be a priest, because you had to produce sons in order to also go into the priesthood. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm just wondering to what extent around this time they would have had full access to all of the scriptures, and especially Paul's teachings, like the book of Hebrews, which is quite explicit with in regards to Christ as the high priest who intercedes for us. So obviously that's quite contradictory within the Catholic Church, who, you know, the Pope asserts himself as the high priest almost. And you know, general British people at the time, the British Church, would they have been aware?
Well, the British Church would certainly have been aware of the canon. I mean, that had been fixed, I think, from about the second century. You had the Vulgate, and I think you also had the Greek translations of the scriptures. I mean, we're talking 600 AD by now. So the canon is fixed, and there would be copies of it. So yes, they would definitely have the Epistle to the Hebrews. They would definitely understand that. And also the Britons were literate. I mean, the Saxons were illiterate. It was a new thing to them, but the Britons were literate. And we know that because it was just a century or two later that the Saxons are going to, Alfred the Great is going to St. David's to ask for a bishop to come and teach his men how to read and write, basically. So yes, they had monks, they had universities, and they would have been rewriting copies up of the scriptures. So they definitely had all of that. The other point here that Augustine is making that he wasn't happy about is that the Britons had a different date for Easter. And Truthvids has contributed the notes to this part. And he says, amongst the various holidays and feasts that the Israelites were commanded to remember and celebrate, one was the Passover. This feast remembers the last plague in Egypt, when the angel of death passed over the children of Israel, who applied the blood of the lamb to their doors. The blood of the lamb on the door was, of course, also foretelling that one day God himself as Christ would sacrifice himself to save the children of Israel, just like this lamb here on the door. To celebrate the Passover, the children of Israel sacrificed a lamb, and then they shared a special meal with their family. In the New Testament, John the Baptist explained, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And this was referring to the blood of Christ, which would cleanse the children of Israel. We see that Christ, born in a stable, visited by shepherds and led to the slaughter, is that lamb that was sent for us. The punishment for sin is death. And since every man has sinned, we all deserve death. Thus, Christ's death and his blood allows the judgment we deserve to pass over us and to be taken upon him. And the Apostle Paul, in his epistle to the Corinthians, also encouraged his readers to keep the Passover, stating, since also our Passover Christ has been sacrificed, meaning Christians should keep the Passover as a memorial of that sacrifice. So that's the origin of this festival that we end up calling Easter. And I think it's quite clear there in the epistle to the Corinthians that we are supposed to follow it. I mean, and it's also telling us that Christ was, or that the lamb that was used in the plagues of Egypt was a prefigure of Christ and his sacrifice. And I think that's also being pointed out there as well. Truthvids, do you want to add anything to that on the original meaning of the Passover?
Yeah, and then every year you would sacrifice a lamb, and that would, as a, how would you say, taking the sins away You know, in reality, you would have to go to a Levitical priest and present a lamb. It was slightly different, but this was just, you know, kind of getting that memory that only sacrificing a lamb can take the sins away, that you can't take your own sins away. And then Christ comes, and then people would realize, oh, it was all foreshadowing and foretelling that one day Christ would have to do this, right?
So it was a Hebrew festival originally, an Israelite festival and holy day, and then that got transformed into a Christian holy day. Patriarch, any thoughts on the Passover here?
Well, going on from the notes here, it went on to become pagan, didn't it, in the association with the egg. So I don't know if Truthvids wants to elaborate on that, and then I'll have...
Yeah, we'll get into that. We'll get into that next. The Orthodox Church calls this holiday Pascha, while Catholics and Protestants call it Easter, named after Ishtar, which is the name of an ancient Babylonian fertility goddess. It's also where we get the word estrogen from, that E-O-S-T-R-E. So it's Estra, Ishtar. All those sorts of words originate in this Babylonian fertility goddess. To celebrate nature's rebirth in the spring equinox, the pagans would hold festivals. And these festivals, especially among the Babylonians, would most likely have included lavish sex rituals and even full-on orgies. The celebration of fertility was replaced with the subtle symbol of the egg, and the hare became the Easter bunny because rabbits reproduce very quickly. And I think that hare bit there comes from the moon. I think there's supposedly like a hare shape that's within the moon. Obviously, rabbits reproduce very quickly. And also around about this time, you also have the May Day festival, which is certainly a pagan festival, a fertility festival about the marriage of the god with the goddess. And this calling Pascha Easter, or calling the Passover Easter, is really naming it in the wrong way. So you're starting out wrong, I think. Truthvids, any things you want to expand on here, or possibly about this hare that became the Easter bunny?
Yeah, I'm sure that all those you know, ancient cultures all had different variations, right? And obviously just the egg symbol was just a subtle way of toning it down, because obviously if they want it to be a Christian festival, they can't you know have pictures of men and women having sex, just an egg and Easter bunnies and you know, where you go have chocolate eggs and all that. But you can see it's kind of about around fertility, right? All these eggs that you're eating.
Yeah, it's sort of like a female festival, isn't it? Even giving it a female name. And Christianity is a Christmas, rather, is a male festival, I think. Patriarch, does that answer your question there? You got any bits you want to add to it?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't actually, I wasn't aware of the actual connection time to sort of pagan rituals, so it's made me rethink about how I'm gonna be celebrating Christmas this year. But as we're supposed to be at least remembering the Passover, which I think somewhat is still remembered to a certain extent, because I mean, I remember as kids always having lamb for dinner. So, you know, there was obviously part pagan, part Passover. And understanding that it is to do with sacrifice and, you know, the lamb. So, you know, I wonder what other rituals that, you know, that the people of Israel actually did to celebrate Passover were.
Well, we know what the Christians do is to fast for Lent, don't they? And they deliberately eat not exciting food, I think, up to this point. And I think that was where this problem came in with the date, because you had the British Church, and perhaps they were in fasting, and then the Roman Church would be celebrating and eating. So, you know, the two would clash there. We'll get into the date problem after this next paragraph, I think. Instead of eliminating the spring equinox and other pagan celebrations altogether, the Romans slowly converted them into Christian rituals. Later, rather than correcting this, the Catholic Church fully embraced these holidays as well. Thus, we should not be celebrating Easter, rather we should be celebrating celebrating the Passover, and we should remember how God saved our forefathers out of Egypt and how Christ sacrificed himself for us, his people. And there is that reference in the New Testament to Paul referring to our forefathers, or our forefather, and he's actually talking about Moses there. So he's saying that the people that he's preaching to, which were the European people, they basically originated in the same people as the Israelites. And that's the sort of thing that we should be remembering at this Passover. Shrewfords, I know you've got some more details on the actual dating of this and how it happened that the British church had a different date to the Roman church. Do you want to get into some of that?
Yeah, so originally the start of the year was spring, right? Because we were an agrarian people, and that's when, you know, the whole world starts to go green. You start planting your crops. I'm not an expert in, you know, farming. I can't tell you every day when you plant this and plant that, you know, but generally that's when it all kind of gets started. And the Passover was always 2 weeks after the start of spring. And then the next day you would have your first fruit. So it's day 15. It's always consistent, because when you plant stuff, again, I'm not an expert on all the crops, but you tend to get little spuds that come up, the first fruits. And then later on you get, you know, more heavy duty crops, and you would offer those first fruits to God. That's what the Hebrews did, you know, and you'd pray that he would watch over you and you'd get a good harvest. So if you have this knowledge, and it seems that the Britons did, they had the scriptures, they could read this, it would seem absolutely insane for someone to come and say, oh no, it's a different date, or it can change, you know, it can vary by a whole month, because it's related to the agrarian dates. You can't, if you get those first fruits and then you wait a month, well, they'll be rotten, right? You know, the day after the Passover or Easter, as the Catholic Church would say. So that's why I think the British were so resistant to it, because it just would just seem lunacy, right? Well, because the Catholic Church was actually following the lunar cycles, the moon. They based it on the first moon, and that's how they would determine Easter, rather than the agrarian, you know, the growing of crops, etc., right?
Yeah, I think it's a week after the first full moon after the equinox, which of course, because of the precession of the equinoxes, I think, or the way that the moon changes, it means that that's going to be at a different time every year, and it's not going to be in time and in tune with the first fruits. So it's going to end up being completely out. And I think the Britons had their calculation of it. They would have got that from Joseph of Arimathea. I mean, the first Christianity that we actually had in Britain was before St. Paul as well. So the traditions that the British church had were the most original, the most closest to primitive Christianity that we have, I think. And these are the ways that we can see that, is from these descriptions and the way that it differed from Roman Christianity. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
No, I think it's just really interesting to you know, consider how to celebrate Easter or the Passover moving forwards. I guess so. It would be a case of, you know, fasting, and then obviously a celebratory meal, ideally lamb, and then maybe I don't know, with being linked to agriculture, sort of giving up the first fruit, so a sort of a tithe and a sort of sense of generosity, maybe. Due, right, to give out and give back.
Yeah, you should have the first vegetables, I guess, that you would have planted in January, and then you'd have the first of them along with your lamb, I should imagine, would be the correct way to observe it. Getting back to Wikipedia, some historians believe that Augustine had no real understanding of the history and traditions of the British Church, damaging his relations with their bishops. Also, there were political dimensions involved, as Augustine's efforts were sponsored by the Kentish king, and at this period the Wessex and Mercian kingdoms were expanding to the west into areas held by the Britons. So you've also got conflict that's going on between the Britons and between the Saxons, and then you've got Augustine, who is saying to the Britons, well, why aren't you seeking to convert these people? And the Britons are like, well, because they're trying to expand into our country and take over parts of our country. That's why we're not seeking to convert them. And what you should be looking at is the conversions of the Picts and the Christian conversions that are going on all around the rest of the country as well. Because the Saxons basically had the southeast of England, and Cornwall, Wales, Northumbria, Scotland, they were still the original Brittonic areas. And I think you had Columba came over at this time, and he was a missionary to the Picts. And as it says, Augustine's mission didn't even convert the Saxons that were on the Isle of Wight for another 50 years. And yet there he was down there in Kent. But the important part about this is that when the British bishop said, well, we'll give you the same respect that is due to any other bishop and any other Christian, but we're not going to we're not going to bow down to your Pope, basically. I mean, we went into the exact response that was given last week. But when the British bishops said that, Augustine then basically put a curse on the Britons and said, well, if you're not going to do that, then death is going to happen to you in the future. And if we move back to R.W. Morgan here now, he's referring to that. He says, Augustine, however, found means to execute his threat. At his persuasions, Ethelbert instigated Ethelfrith, the pagan king of Northumbria, to invade the territories of Brocwell, Prince of Powys, who had supported Dunawood and the bishops in their rejection of the papal claims. And Dunawood was the chief bishop that was involved. Powys then embraced Cheshire and Shropshire, its capitals being Penguin or Shrewsbury and Chester. Ethelfrith, with an army of 50,000 men, poured into the Vale Royal and was encountered by Brockwell at Chester. On an eminence near the field of battle were 1,200 British priests of the University of Bangor, that's Bangor on Dee, in their white canonicals, totally unarmed, assembled to offer up their prayers for the success of the Christian arms. And remember, this is a tradition that goes back to the Druids. If you're a priest, you were not armed and you were sacred, and nobody would fire on you, nobody would attack you on the battlefield. That was considered completely uncivilized, because this was a man of religion and a man of peace. So they were basically, the Britons were expecting the Saxons to uphold this, which was just a generally known part of civilized behavior, was not to attack priests. While the engagement was raging, Ethelfrith, observing them, asked who the soldiers in white were and why, instead of joining in the battle, they remained on their knees. On being informed that they were the priests of Bangor engaged in prayer to the Christians' God, "If they are praying against us to their God," exclaimed the ferocious heathen, "they are fighting against us as much as if they attacked us with arms in their hands." And directing his forces in person against them, he massacred them to a man. He then advanced to the university itself, put as many priests and students as had not fled at his approach to the sword, and consigned its numerous halls, colleges, and churches to the flames. "Thus was fulfilled," exclaims the pious Bede, "the prediction of the blessed Augustine, the prophet being in truth the perpetrator." So this was caused by Augustine, and it's Bede that's writing about this. So this is where we get the evidence for this from. And this is quite a famous massacre, I think, in Welsh history. You won't find that much about it online. You'll probably find it on the Wikipedia page on Bangor on Dee. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Well, yeah, if he really believed in his prophecy, then he believed, I'm speaking of Augustine, sorry, then he would have believed that God would have brought this out, right? But he himself instigated it. So he didn't really believe it was a prophecy. He himself sneakily organized an invasion, and he caused the massacre, right? And this was only, one part of Britain. It wasn't like the entirety of Britain got massacred for this. So it was very unchristian of him, right, to demand that they bow down to him. If not, they'll be wiped out, right? No Christian should ever want that on other Christians, right?
Yeah, and you think this, you know, this was churches, this was a university, this was a place of learning that the Saxons destroyed. I mean, this is why they had this reputation of just being thugs and idiots, basically, barbarians, just destroying civilization wherever they went. I mean, you've got religious people here and you've got students, and yet you still got these kings, Aethelfrith and the other one, that just go there and massacre them all. And it's similar to the Romans when they did similar to Anglesey on the Isle of Anglesey, and they destroyed and burnt down all the Druidic groves and the university that was there, and they destroyed it. And I think you've got the same thing here. You've got the Saxons doing the same. And to think this was a Christian university that was headed by a bishop, Dunord, and he was the one that headed the mission to Canterbury, to the conference, rather, to Augustine, and it was the head of that mission that was also the head of this university. So they knew, Augustine knew that he was Christian, knew that it was a Christian university, and yet he basically arranged for the Saxons to go there and destroy it. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Yeah, obviously the Saxons and the peoples were still pagan at that time, right? So what would their general beliefs?
The pagans, I mean, we went into some of their beliefs last week, didn't we? They didn't really have many. I mean, they had wooden sheds. They built wooden sheds, and we think they put idols in them. And they didn't even build things made of stone. They probably would have repurposed the dolmens, maybe, and the areas that are used before as parts of the sacred landscape, the same as the Christians did. I should imagine they probably did that. Let me just check here which king it was that is alleged to have done that. Aethelfrith is the one that did that. Aethelbert and Aethelfrith. And was it Aethelbert that was entertaining Augustine? I'm just trying to have a look here. Just going up there. Was it Aethelfrith? Yes, it was. It was Aethelbert. So you're right there. Yeah, it was the Christian king that went up there and got Aethelfrith and fought with Aethelfrith in Chester against these priests there. So yes, it was the king that was that actually converted to Christianity. I'm not sure whether he'd actually converted at this point, but when he converted, all his men converted as well. This is Aethelfrith that was with his queen, was a Christian queen that came from the Frankish kings, and he was responsible for this, according to R.W. Morgan. So it was the king that was entertaining Augustine. Whether he had become a Christian at this point or not, we do not know. I guess you would have to have a look at Bede. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, another point I was going to make is how do they know that they were praying against them? I mean, as Christians, you know, you're supposed to pray for your enemies as opposed to against them. So I just wonder why they got that impression that they were kind of calling on God to smite the Saxons.
That's a good point there. And it doesn't say. So again, perhaps that would have been a representative of Augustine that said that. Because it just says he on being informed that they were the priests of Bangor engaged in prayer to the Christians' God. And then it has a quote there. So it doesn't actually say who it was that was responding to Aethelfrith in saying that. But I should imagine it could well have been Augustine or some of his men that explained that to them. And again, I think this shows us that you know, this understanding of Christianity was very different to the understanding today, because I don't think they would have been praying for their enemies. I mean, they would have been praying for God to deliver their enemies into their hand. And I think if they lost the battle, they would have seen it as they had displeased God. And if they won the battle, they would see it that they had done the right thing. If you remember when we were talking about King Arthur, and after he won his battles, there was a golden age because everybody was obeying the Christian law. because they thought, well, God has done this for us, and you know, so we will magnify God, we'll magnify Christianity, and we'll obey all these Christian laws because of it. So so even though the Bible tells us that we should love our enemies, I think that means love your enemies amongst your own people, not love the enemies of God, because they would have seen this pagan horde as being the enemies of God, you know, and who were going to burn down the university.
To pray for their conversion, ultimately, to pray for their souls and they knew that they had to live side by side by them. So, and end of the day, I guess, God works how he works. And, you know, like you say, he, in the end, it went down the sort of more aggressive route of conversion. But I guess prayer was answered in one way or another.
Well, it was an arranged battle as well. It was an arranged battle. I mean, they had ways to arrange these things, and the Britons were waiting to fight against them. And obviously their priests were there praying for them in the same tradition that the Druids had. That the Druids would be there praying for the success.
Oh, right. Sorry. I missed that. Okay.
Well, getting back to what Wiki has to say about this, a monastery was established at Bangor in about AD 560 by Saint Dunawood. And I think R.W. Morgan is of the opinion that that monastery was actually much older than that. That's like a revisionist history to say that it was only there. It had only been built for 50 years. Because we know how many bishops there were already in the country. It was an important religious centre in the 5th and the 6th centuries. The monastery was destroyed in about 613 by the Anglo-Saxon king Ethelfrith of Northumbria, after he defeated the Welsh armies at the Battle of Chester, which probably took place near Bangor-on-Dee. A number of the monks then transferred to Bardsey Island and appear among lists of saints. And Bardsey Island is, again, it's just off Anglesey. I think if you look at the map of Wales, it looks like a finger that's pointing out. And right on the tip of that finger is this island, which is a very holy island. And that's Bardsey Island. So there's no mention here in Wikipedia of the King from Kent being there as well, but it was the King from Kent as well as the King from Ethelfrith, according to R.W. Morgan. Before the battle, monks from the monastery had fasted for 3 days and then climbed a hill to witness the fight and pray for the success of the Welsh. They were massacred on the orders of Ethelfrith. The scholar Bede wrote that 1,200 monks were slaughtered and only 50 escaped. Other accounts are very different in terms of the numbers killed and the date. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, for example, states that 200 priests were slain at Chester in 607. More than a millennium later, the massacre was recounted in a poem entitled The Monks of Bangor's March by Walter Scott, and it was put to music by Ludwig van Beethoven. Today, no trace of the monastery remains, and even its site is uncertain. It is possible that all the buildings, including the church, were built of wattle and daub. So it was an important part of history that was known about. I mean, all it's got today is if you look up Bangor-on-Dee, you can find a small bit of information about it. But if you look up the Bangor Massacre, for instance, you won't be able to find it. And yet it was that important that it was put to music by Ludwig van Beethoven. So it was obviously far more known about in the time of Beethoven's day in Europe than it is today, which I find very surprising. Truthfords, any thoughts on this massacre?
Well, it shows you that the priorities on history are very different now than they were back then. Then the slaughtering of Christians and monks or priests was seen as a great tragedy, right? People had dedicated their lives to God, but nowadays not so much. I would have liked to have seen what they had in that library, you know, all the ancient books and that, and chronicles, if it was burnt down, another bit of history lost. But as for the building being lost, you know, often when a building was destroyed, people would go and take the stones to build you know, new structures, and that's how it would all disappear, because they would use the building materials, right?
That's a really good point. So it may not have been wattle and daub, because all the building materials are recycled. I think we, you know, there's so much lost information, isn't there? We probably only have about 1% of all the knowledge that was ever written down. I mean, when you look at the old historians, the classic historians, they are referring to books that we don't actually have copies of anymore. I mean, Flavius Josephus is so important, because his history contains quotes and tells us about all these other histories that we don't actually have copies of anymore. You know, there's so much of the knowledge that we had is now lost. Any thoughts on that, Patriarch?
I'm just interested in what resulted, what came after this massacre, and you know what transpired in the British Isles. I mean, what effect? Because it would have had a big impact, wouldn't it, on the rest of the nation? Maybe it kind of it was the beginnings of a new chapter, and it was in some ways it became, although it was like a tragedy, obviously it was paving the way for a silver lining.
Yeah, it certainly spurred the Britons on to avenge the massacre. We'll get into that. We'll just continue here with some more evidence for it. Archaeological excavations at Heron Bridge, just south of Chester, in 2004, uncovered post-Roman graves buried beneath a defensive earthwork over an old Roman settlement. There is evidence that they contain the bodies of casualties from the Battle of Chester. Interestingly, they say that it was an old Roman settlement. I mean, that's probably your evidence of stone that was there, and that would have been built by the Britons, not by the Romans. I mean, that might be the evidence of some of this university that was damaged. And the mainstream historians today, whenever they find anything like that, they'll say, oh, well, it has to be Roman. You know, can't have been the Britons. I also had a look at the official records from the parish church at Bangor, which make mention of King Lucius. In AD 180, Lucius, a king of Britain, was converted by the preaching of one of the Christian fathers to the faith. He is said to have founded the monastery of Bangor as a seat of learning. And remember, because the dates could be 30 years out, because whether it was at the birth of Christ or whether it was at the resurrection, that's why we say Britain became a Christian nation. It could have been in 150 AD rather than 180 AD. But this is what's being referred to here. And this is the official church records say that Lucius, the king of Britain, was the one that set up that monastery. So Wikipedia is telling us that this monastery wasn't created until 500 AD, yet the church itself and the official church records tell us that it was set up in 180 AD. So it had a long history there. The area was inhabited by the Britons until the Romans came and conquered it in 50 AD. The location was on the south side of the River Dee, which is now ploughed ground. It was over a mile in length and like a walled town. There were two gates. The north gate was called Porthogham, and the south gate, a mile away, was called Porthclays. This doesn't sound like Watling Daub to me. This sounds like a huge complex of university buildings. There were seven bishops of the Britons, and I would suggest that was probably the archbishops, and the monastery was divided into seven parts with a ruler over each and over 300 men in each part. The Romans departed about the 5th century when the Saxons arrived. The Saxons coveted the rich cultivated meadows of the valley belonging to the monks. The warlike king of the English, Ethelfrith, raised a mighty army, and a battle ensued between Chester and Bangor on Dee. That's between the two areas, not that that was the two armies. Over 1,200 monks were killed, and only about 50 managed to escape. The monastery did not survive the massacre. This was in 613 AD. Bangor on Dee was recognised as a rectory in 1300 AD, and Bangor Church was dedicated in the name of St. Dunawood, who was a distinguished abbot of the ancient monastery. It was originally built with wattles from the marsh, and in the course of time, the Watling Daub was replaced with timber, and it was many centuries later before a permanent building of stone was built. So the Watling Daub being referred to there was being built in 1300 AD, not earlier, where it tells us that it was like a walled town and it was over a mile in length. So this was a great centre of learning that was basically destroyed by the Saxons. I find it really interesting that comes from the official parish church website, that comes from the official church in Wales, you know, tells us that. And yet the opposite of that is what Wikipedia tells us. It tells us that it was only built, it was Watling Daub, and it was only built in the 5th century AD. Yet the church's history itself says it was built in 180 AD by the King Lucius, who was Christian. That's Christian 200 years before Rome. And it was like a walled town. So, you know, it's like the official story is different here, isn't it? Because this has got to be the official story. It's from the church. And yet Wikipedia claimed to be put in the official story there. Any thoughts, Treefids?
Well, yeah, it shows you that Wikipedia is completely dishonest, right? And if you try to edit that, and, you know, on Wikipedia, it's meant to be that anyone can edit it if they have evidence and provide citations, but you just get banned, right? They'll never let you edit it. It's clearly a propaganda piece under the guise of being, you know, free universal information. But I thought it was interesting how it says the Britons, it was inhabited by the Britons until the Romans came and conquered it in 50 AD. Well, how did a British king build it in 150 or 180 AD if the Romans supposedly ruled over Britain, right? That doesn't make sense. Either there were British kings or there were Roman. So who built it, a British king or the Roman? It doesn't make sense, right? You've got to realize that perhaps the Romans didn't rule Britain at that time, right?
Yeah, there's all these inconsistencies there, isn't there? I mean, for 40 years, we were resisting the Romans, and then we had a treaty with them, and we got rid of them in the time of Boadicea, I think, and then they came back, and we were allowed to keep our own laws. And a lot of people say about Wikipedia, they say, well, obviously the history is biased during World War II, and people will say Wikipedia is biased towards the Jews or biased towards a positive view of Israel. But most people aren't aware that there's things like this that have been distorted as well. Things like just British history. It's quite incredible, really. Patriarch, any thoughts?
I'm just thinking where it is located at the River Dee, but there's no actual city called Bangor. The only Bangor I've found in the UK is Northern Ireland. So I wonder if there's any association there. But also, Bangor, the meaning is essentially a what's called a wattle fence. The name is a wattle fence or an enclosure. So I don't know if it alludes to some form of, kind of guarded settlement, but it's not a strong fence. It's like a wooden fence. Like a wooden fence that's put up. So I just wonder if there's a relationship between the name of the word Bangor and the reasons for why the battle was there.
Well, it was between Bangor and Chester, and the Bangor in Wales is Bangor on Dee, and I think there's another place that's called Bangor in Wales as well. I know there is also in Ireland. And that shows you that this Celtic language or this Cymric language, it was the same language that was used in Ireland as used in Wales. But yeah, Bangor on Dee is the actual one to look up. That's probably why you couldn't find the Bangor in Wales. And yeah, the enclosure, and that's probably where the origin of the word is from. It was just an enclosure that was there. But as I say, I mean, I don't think it was Watland Door, because it said that the church records say that it was like a walled town, a mile in size.
Yeah, walled. I think that's where the root of the name comes from. It was walled, but it depends. I don't know. Was it a strong wall or was it just a kind of a basic fence?
Well, I think it would have been a proper wall. It would have been stones. I mean, because when they found evidence of those bodies, they said that it was a Roman settlement, and if they're calling it a Roman settlement, then it was made with stone, because they tried to pretend that the Britons didn't know how to put one stone on top of the other. You know, even though we have these great dolmens dotted all the way across Wales, you know, with 80 ton capstones put on top of three uprights, as if people that knew how to do that were not capable of putting smaller bricks one on top of the other. I mean, it's a ridiculous idea. Getting back to R.W. Morgan, attempting to force the passage of the Dee, that's the River Dee, Ethelfrith was repulsed by Brockwell and a few days afterwards routed with the loss of 10,000 of his men by Cadvan, he himself escaping wounded and with great difficulty to Lichfield. Cadvan pursued his victory by overrunning the country to the estuary of the Humber and besieging Ethelfrith in York. Peace was concluded by Aethelfrith's acknowledging the sovereignty of the Pendragon over the whole island and surrendering, among others, his youthful relative Edwin, King of Deira, as a hostage to the conqueror. The British army, in returning, halted at the scene of the devastation at Bangor. The ashes of the noble monastery were still smoking. Its libraries, the collection of ages, were consumed. Half-ruined walls, gates, and smouldering rubbish were all that remained of its magnificent edifices, and these were everywhere crimsoned with the blood and interspersed with the bodies of priests, students, and choristers. The scene left a quenchless desire for further vengeance on the minds of the Cymric soldiery. So we're told there that it wasn't as if the Saxons won this battle after that. The Saxons lost the battle and they ended up having to acknowledge the sovereignty of Cadvan, who we'll hear some more about later on, I think. Any thoughts on this, Trufitz?
Yeah, it shows you that the British or Cymry weren't quite out yet, that they still held a lot of power and they were able to reclaim the island, right? Until, I believe, later on we'll get into it, the rise of Mercia and then Alfred the Great, right?
Yeah, we certainly will. And you also see here that a hostage is being handed over. That was an important part of the world at that time. When something like this happened, in order to ensure that there was a peace, a hostage would be taken. I mean, this goes back to Roman times, doesn't it, when Caractacus was taken to Rome and then his grandfather had to come there, Bran, and his sons had to come there as well, and they were held as hostages to ensure that the Silurians would not continue to fight against Rome back in Britain. So they were all sort of held as hostages. Patriarch, any thoughts on the aftermath of the battle here?
So it was a clear loss then for the Saxons.
Yes. Yes, I mean, we lost our prince, our priests rather, we lost our library, we lost our university, but we didn't lose the battle with the king. And I guess that must come from Bede or the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. I think R.W. Morgan is pretty good with his sources. You know, he's pretty accurate. But he doesn't actually list them, but that would have been where he got them from, I think. Continuing here with R.W. Morgan. Ceolwulf, the West Saxon king, penetrating into Silurea, or Siluria, AD 610, was defeated by Tewdric, the hermit king, then in his 100th year on the banks of the Wye. Tewdric expired in the moment of victory, supported by his officers on horseback, his dying gaze fixed on the Saxons in flight. He was buried at the old palace at Matern. Kent and Essex relapsed, AD 616, on the deaths of Ethelbald and Siebert back into paganism. Edwin, king of Deira, had meanwhile been educated by Cadvan with his own son Cadwallo at Carnarvon. Carnarvon is in North Wales, and this Edwin, the king of Deira, that was the one that was taken as hostage by Cadvan. So he's been educated alongside Cadvan's son Cadwallo. In AD 617, by the aid of Redwald of Essex, Edwin, that's the king of Deira, defeated and slew his uncle Aethelfrid on the east bank of the Idle in Nottinghamshire. In AD 626, there was an attempt to have him assassinated with a poisoned dagger by Yoma, an emissary of Quickelm of Wessex. His life was saved by his minister Lilla, springing up before him and receiving the dagger in his own bosom. Cadvan was succeeded by Cadwallo, and in AD 628, Edwin, on hearing of his accession and trusting to their earlier friendship, sent an embassy to Chester, requesting permission to wear a royal crown instead of the usual coronet of the sub-kings. Cadwallon peremptorily refused, stating that the usages of Britain had only permitted but one Diadema Britannia, or Crown of Britain, to be worn in the island. Incensed by the refusal, Edwin threw off his allegiance and, on Cadwallo's invading of Northumbria, defeated him in a great battle at Widrington, 8 miles north of Morpeth. So we see that at this time, it was the sovereignty over the whole island was still belonging to the Britons, because the biggest Saxon kings before that were not as powerful as Cadvan, and obviously the kingship passed on to Cadwallo. I think that's what we can pick up from this. Truthfids, anything you want to pick up on in there?
Yeah, so Edwin would have actually been Christian and raised by Cadwallo. Obviously, he'd also have great knowledge of his military tactics, right? He would have been raised there and seen, you know, all his army and that. So that gave him probably an advantage to prepare. And that's probably how he defeated him as well, right? And also the Christian beliefs would now be in Northumbria as well, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point there. And also the way that these Saxons that became Christian, they relapsed into paganism as soon as those particular kings died. Anything you want to pick up on there, Patriarch?
I was just going to mention that about the relapsing. So there weren't really strong bonds, or it wasn't a an honest sort of conversion in the first place. So it must have been forced, right? It must have just been, because they didn't have much power to resist. So they had it foisted on them. And so at any moment, they took the opportunity to fall back into paganism.
Yeah, I think we can contrast that with all the British marchers that there were for Christianity. What was the name of the emperor? Diocletian. There were Diocletian persecutions, where we get the name of St. Albans from. I think there were 2,000 or 12,000 marchers in Britain that were all martyred for Christianity. So they would rather die than give up their beliefs, and that was the Britain's Christianity. And then you have Augustine's Christianity, which as soon as the king dies, everybody gives up on. So I think that's a contrast that we can put there. So Cadwallo has lost this battle after invading Northumbria. He's been defeated by Edwin, and Cadwallo was the sovereign of the island. So now the sovereignty obviously passes back to the Saxons. Cadwallo, after an exile of 5 years in Ireland and Armorica, landed at Torquay. Penda Strenuus, a king of Mercia and ally of Edwin, was at that time, AD 634, besieging Exeter. The siege was raised and Penda was taken prisoner by Cadwallo. On being liberated by the intercession of his sister at the feet of Cadwallo, he swore allegiance to the Pendragon, an oath which he observed with religious fidelity throughout his life. And remember, Pendar, I think, was pagan as well. Cadwallo, struck with the charms of Elditha, the sister, married her. The issue of the marriage was Cadwal the Sanctus, the last Pendragon and sole monarch of Britain from the British dynasty. In his father's right, he was the heir of Cambria, and in his mother's right, he was the heir of Mercia and Wessex. So this is quite important here. So you have the former sovereign of the island comes back. He sees that this fight is going on at Exeter, and Edwin, the guy that kicked him out, the fight is being waged by Pendar, who is an ally of Edwin. Pendar is beaten, and he's taken hostage, and his sister intercedes for him, and where Cadwallo is enamoured with the sister, I guess you could say, besotted with the sister, he ends up marrying the sister, and he ends up accepting this oath of Pendar that he will, that his allegiance will be to the Pendragon, even though he's a pagan. So now you have an alliance between the Christians and the pagans, basically. And this leads on to a lot of battles. He's quite an important character, this Pendar, and also Cadwallo. Any thoughts on this, Truthfids?
Yeah, so now he's allied with Mercia, which is the middle of England, and now he's against Northumbria, right? That northern part. So you see that there's constant allegiances here between the Anglo-Saxons and the Britons. It's not how history depicts that the Anglo-Saxons, there was just constant war and no intermixing, when clearly there is. They're intermarrying, and you can see that the royalties would have claim to both territories, and you know, the people under them must have been intermixing as well, right? Becoming the modern British.
Yeah, the intermarriages also provided this claim to being able to rule as well, exactly the same as happened with the Romans. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I thought the name was, his name's quite interesting, Cadwallawr Sanctus. So it's sort of, the first name's Welsh, and then the second is clearly a sort of, is it Latin or origin or Greek origin, which is a word for holy. So I just wondered, there's obviously, his name suggests the union there, doesn't it? The joining together almost.
Yeah, you got the Cymric name, and you've also got a Latin word saying that he is sanctified. So he was obviously holy. So the Christian religion was starting to play a really important role in this as well. Now, as we'll get on to, we'll probably get it more into that next week. We'll just continue with this for now. The career of Cadwallo from this date was so merciless that his name for generations afterwards continued as a word of terror against the Anglo-Saxons. He bound himself by a vow as sanguinary as that of Hannibal towards the Romans that he would not leave an Angle alive between the Humber and the Forth, and he well nigh kept it. 16 victories of his are recorded in various parts of the kingdom by contemporary authors. Edwin and the flower of the Anglo-Saxon nobility fell before him at the Battle of Hatfield Chase, which is Meghan in Yorkshire, AD 633, long the theme of a mournful song and dirge to the Saxon scolds. And remember, he's not the holy guy, it's his son that was the one that was remembered as being holy. This is the father who has got this alliance with Pendar, the pagan. Osric, Eanfrid, and with the exception of Oswald, the whole Odin or Ida family of Northumbria were extirpated by him, and the country reduced by sword and fire to ashes and wilderness. The year of these calamities, AD 634, was, states Bede, obliterated, like the anniversary of the Battle of the Allia in the Roman, from the Saxon calendar. It is singular that the only two instances recorded of this discalendering of times of national disaster should have been caused by the victories of the same Cymric race over two of the most warlike nations of ancient and modern times, the Roman and the Saxon. And we talked about the Battle of the Allia. That was when we talked about Brennus and Belinus, the two British kings that went over into Italy, and the Etruscans were there at the time, and they defeated the Romans, basically. It's a very famous battle, although they'll try and tell you that the leaders of it were from Gaul, but that's because the British kings were also the kings of Gaul. They had a right to be there as well. And they took this army, and they went to fight against the Romans. And there's a very famous bit where the Romans are having to pay all this gold to these kings, and he throws his sword into the scales as well. So they had to pay even more. And they said, by what right do you do that? And he's saying, by right of being the conqueror. You just basically have to give in. It's a very interesting tale, actually. We talked about that a while back, just myself and Patriarch, as part of this series. So what R.W. Morgan is likening that here to this defeat of the Saxons. And that's because Bede says that it was the year itself was obliterated from the Saxon calendar, because they were basically destroyed all with the exception of Oswald. So we see there that Edwin and Cadwallo, they've basically smashed Northumbria. So as you were saying, Truford, it's so different to this idea that the Saxons just came in and wiped out these pathetic Britons. That isn't what happened. And there was these alliances and these intermarriages, because they were effectively the same people, the Britons and the Saxons. They might have had slightly different languages, but that was all. Biologically, they were the same people. They were brother races. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Yeah, so here we see that the Anglo-Saxons are being smashed, but now they're going to start Christianizing, which we'll get to next, right, and soon. And then the tables start to turn, right? And I think there would be infighting amongst the British as well. And it really shows you that you really just need a great Christian leader, and you need to be united, right? That's what really counts in all these constant wars, right?
Yeah, it was the division that led to the failure, and as we'll see in the next episode, once the Saxons became Christian, there was some great Christians amongst them that did end up beating the Britons. Patriarch, any thoughts on this and the smashing of the Northumbrian Saxons?
Yeah, I'm just trying to play. So the Romans were they allied with the Britons at this time? Against the Saxons, was it just the Roman settlements?
No, the Romans. It was years back with the battle between Brennus and Belinus. It was, I think, third or the fourth century BC. What R.W. Morgan is saying is because that with that Battle of the Allia was removed from the Roman calendar. They removed that year. It was called the Black Year or whatever because Rome just got destroyed by this army of Britons and Gauls that was led by Brennus and Belinus, these two British kings. So what R.W. Morgan is saying is that Bede has done the same thing. Bede says that this year was such a terrible year for the Saxons that they removed it from the calendar. So what R.W. Morgan is saying, it's something that we can be proud of, is that both of these events in history where a year was removed from the calendar because the loss was so great, the ignominy of losing the battle was so great. In both instances, it was the Cymry that were the victors in that battle. Mm. So that's the point that he's making.
Okay.
But we should probably leave that here, I think, and we'll get into the origins of Oswestry and this Oswald, who has been saved out of this whole Odin family. We'll talk about that in the next episode. It's interesting as well that R.W. Morgan refers here to the Odin family, because that, as we talked about before, that was this family line, that was where the Saxon got their right to rule from, is that they were descended from Odin, who was a real person, who was a real king. So we'll get into that in the next episode anyway. So thank you very much for coming on today, Truthvids.
Thanks for having me, Sven, as always.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, Sven. Thanks for the information.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with another Patriotic History for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.